This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinton.
Well, Margaret, we're still assessing the fallout from the midterm elections that gave the GOP control of both the House and the Senate after an extremely low voter turnout.
And almost immediately, Mark, the heir apparent to become Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, is vowing repeal of the health care law, a sentiment that was echoed by his partner in the House, Speaker John Boehner. And this is in spite of a number of polls that show a majority of Americans favor keeping the Affordable Care Act and instead working to tweak or improve upon some of its more challenging aspects.
But more troubling is a challenge to the health care law that recently surfaced. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case questioning the legality of the tax subsidies for Americans who purchase insurance on the federal exchange in 36 states across the country.
Some may consider the premise of the suit frivolous, centering on simple semantics in the Affordable Care Act. But the fact that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case is certainly cause for concern.
Oh, it really is. But this harkens back to the Supreme Court decision on the ACA in 2012, a nail-biter which upheld the legality of the Affordable Care Act, but dismantled the requirement that all states expand Medicaid. That decision led to the patchwork quilt of coverage we see across the nation, Margaret, as a majority of states refuse to expand Medicaid based on the Supreme Court ruling.
Well, at the very least, it begets a tremendous amount of uncertainty, again, around the health care law for citizens as well as for policymakers and stakeholders. That decision, though, not expected until June of 2015, so it still weighs off in another round of enrollment about to begin.
We're now officially in our second round of open enrollment. We're expecting millions more Americans to gain coverage from November 15th of this year to February 15th. The folks running the federal exchange, healthcare.gov, are promising a better experience this time around.
And one piece of legislation that's had a direct impact on care delivery in this country is the 2009 HITECH Act, which incentivized providers and hospitals to switch from paper records to electronic records. And we've seen a dramatic uptick in adoption since that legislation was passed, but still a long way to go to realize truly meaningful use of all this newly generated electronic health data.
Our guest today, Dr. Peter Bash, is an internist and is the senior fellow for the health IT policy with the Center for American Progress. He's considered a leading expert on health IT and its potential to assist in transforming healthcare.
He's been utilizing electronic health records as a practicing primary care internist for a couple of decades in his practice, and he has a practical long-term view of the benefits as well as some of the challenges to adoption.
Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks into more false claims spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or at CHC Radio on Twitter. We love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Peter Bash in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Mary Ann O'Hara, with this week's headline news.
I'm Mariano here with these healthcare headlines. Round two of open enrollment is underway under the Affordable Care Act, and folks at the Department of Health and Human Services are expecting a smoother go of things this time around. In spite of several difficulties with the online portals last year, more than 7 million people signed up for insurance on the exchanges. Some 8.5 million Americans gained coverage through expanded Medicaid, and millions of young Americans were able to stay on their parents' plan up to age 26. While technicians ran triage on the federal and state exchanges last year amid much turmoil, there's been time for recalibration. Kevin Cunahan, who ran Connecticut's successful Access Health CT state exchange, is now in charge of the federal site, healthcare.gov. Some changes to the site have been made to enhance the capacity for volume processing. Meanwhile, the Kaiser Family Foundation is offering 5 tips on how to navigate the exchanges for those signing up for the first time and those re-enrolling on a new plan. Number one, shop around. Policies have hidden costs, and there are more options to choose from this year. Number two, don't get billed twice. If you're changing policies through healthcare.gov, make sure the existing health plan you have is officially canceled. Number three, find out if you qualify for financial help or subsidies. Around $46,000 in income for an individual or $96,000 for a family of four are the thresholds under which you'll get subsidies to offset the cost of buying insurance. Number four, know all of the costs. Many plans have higher deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. Know what you'll be paying, not just in premiums, but in coverage. Number five, ask for help. There's assistance online at healthcare.gov, on the phone as well, and they are trained to navigate all the myriad options available to you. Open enrollment closes February 15th. Numbers in health news. 28,000, the number of doctors needed to fill gaps in the Veterans Health Administration. New VA Secretary Robert McDonald says the dramatic increase in patient populations with the two recent wars has added to the strain and to the delays. Since problems at the VA came to light earlier this year, more than a million appointments have been made, and Secretary McDonald is also looking at ways to enhance a public-private partnership to meet the growing demand at the VA and change the perceived culture so that more providers might look to the VA as a medical career choice. And we're down to zero, the number of Ebola patients in the U.S. A New York doctor being treated for the illness was released after successful treatment. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Bash, an internist and medical director for ambulatory EHR and health IT policy at MedStar Health. Dr. Bash is senior fellow for health IT policy at the Center for American Progress and is a visiting scholar with the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institute. He represents the American College of Physicians at the Physicians EHR Coalition, and he's received numerous awards, including the HIMSS IT Leadership Award. Dr. Bash earned his medical degree at George Washington University School of Medicine and conducted his residency at George Washington University Hospital. Dr. Bash, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Oh, that's great. And you're a self-described physician geek. We love those. Who was one of the early adopters of electronic health records about 20 years ago. And the nation's practices were rather slow to adopt these technologies until the 2009 high-tech act spurred adoption by providing financial incentives to providers to switch from paper to electronic health records. And while the adoption has picked up pace, in a recent health affairs blog post, you observe that we've reached sort of this pivotal juncture with EHRs, and we've moved beyond the sort of magical thinking that simple adoption of health records will improve care outcomes. So what's the realistic assessment of where we are on the path to meaningful use at this stage of the game?
I'm a practicing doc and one who early on saw benefit in health information technology applied to clinical practice. Not really a geek. Now, I have nothing against geeks, but what I've often seen from geeks is what I would describe kind of a zealous love of solutions in search of a problem rather than solutions for actual problems.
Perfect.
And I believe that this may explain to some extent why we're not further along the path towards health IT adoption and optimization for patient care. To your question as to where we are on the meaningful use path, I think it's fair to say we've made a lot of progress in only a few short years. You've identified me as one of probably several hundred or several thousand early adopters going back decades ago. And if we had stayed on that same adoption path as what we saw in the first couple of decades, it would probably be several more decades before we saw an advancement of health IT adoption. So we need to credit meaningful use for rapid cycling adoption and improving basic electronic health record literacy, as well as, very importantly, the concept and practice of sharing information with patients. We have to give credit to MU for helping to move EHRs from geek stream to mainstream. But all kidding aside, I believe we are at an inflection point now where there is a serious risk of program collapse. And my concern is not just based on what I hear from colleagues, but also most recently from CMS itself. Just last week, CMS released its latest MU attestation stats for stage two, showing only 17% of hospitals and only 2% of doctors have attested for stage two thus far. In my opinion, MU is at serious risk of failing.
Well, Dr. Bash, you're a primary care internist, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Yes.
So well familiar with all of the issues trying to improve our work in prevention and health promotion and chronic disease management, as well as taking care of the problem the patient showed up with today. We recently had Dr. Karen DeSalva, who's now left that to go attend to another crisis. We talked a lot about this aggressive campaign that was underway to accelerate the pathway towards meaningful use in the coming decade. And as you point out, how do you accelerate something that seems to be a little bit slowed or stalled? So maybe tell us more about that roadmap that you think we need to be on to keep that momentum moving forward.
Sure. So let me start by saying I have great respect for Dr. DeSalvo, and I would say that anyone, not just Dr. DeSalvo, but anyone who believes in the potential for health IT to be enabling infrastructure for making healthcare better and safer wants to hurry up and get the job done. And certainly at this point where we are seeing much more pain than gain, but I would disagree when it seems to me that we're moving in the wrong direction. Is it prudent to stay on the same path and just go faster? I think not, and I think accelerating progress in provider use of EHRs requires a mid-course correction and most likely either more flexibility in measures or alternate pathways for success. The 10-year roadmap for interoperability, which is computer-to-computer information sharing that is both useful and usable, is based, I think, smartly on moving forward iteratively. But I'm afraid it's predicated on a faulty foundation. The early years of the interoperability roadmap depend on EHR usability of the receiving provider, which is, at least ideally, a non-coercive way to drive providers toward choosing digital communication over phone, fax, or what often happens now is no communication at all. So we know that a particular format of information defines usefulness and usability, the so-called five rights of information, the right information in the right format via the right vehicle to the right person at the right point in workflow. And I would say as currently configured, this first stage of interoperability provides for only two of the five rights. Furthermore, providers complain that they take more time finding information in their EHRs than in paper records. We have added a burden of sifting through way too much information, and this is a mandated format upon which current interoperability is founded, is overdefined with the same mandated fields regardless of setting or specialty. The result is, in my view, a bloated and unreadable set of data, in many cases exceeding the equivalent of 70 through 100 pages, with most of it unwanted filler, thus all but guaranteeing that the receiving provider's experience is a waste of time. Certainly, that's not a situation anybody wants to see. So what do we need to change first? I think first we need to pivot from the current monolithic view of CMS and ONC that the potential benefit and use of EHRs should be the same for all providers. And as EHR certification requirements are driven by these meaningful use measures, the regulatory driver for EHR development has led, unfortunately, not to innovation, but I believe EHR homogeneity, the end result being that many docs find their EHR looks like it was built for someone else. And it is not only not useful for their specialty, or for people such as myself who are in primary care, we feel that the EHR doesn't offer the complexity that we need to make it useful in our field. Secondly, having an electronic send and receive requirement that moves messages faster but mandates the messages include hundreds, if not thousands, of irrelevant data points needs to be undone. All provider-to-provider and provider-to-patient messaging has mandated fields. Further, there are mandatory measures in stage two that are irrelevant for many providers. For example, there is a requirement for all providers, no exceptions for scope of practice, for preventive or chronic care reminders. So even if you don't practice preventive or chronic care, 10% of your patients must get reminders for preventive or chronic care. Certainly not just a waste of time, but a way to make providers who might otherwise consider meaningful use meaningful change their mind.
Dr. Bash, as we shifted our focus now to sort of the elephant in the room, the lack of interoperability, we realize it will likely require far more cooperation between the stakeholders and policymakers to sort of incentivize interoperability. In your recent health affairs piece, you did acknowledge that a majority of the providers and hospitals across the country now have functioning health IT systems, and there's a growing degree of EHR literacy, all of which has begun to yield some positive effects with patient-provider relationships. Where have you seen those benefits best displayed?
So I don't believe the elephant is the absence of technical interoperability, but rather how interoperability is currently shaped by meaningful use regulations is not particularly desirable. The most successful incentive will have EHRs work, be usable, and have electronic messaging be flexible and work to solve problems, and not just clutter digital records with irrelevant but mandated information, what I have heard described as interoperable. I would venture it's a safe bet that prior to meaningful use, most doctors rarely did a careful medication and allergy list review with their patients. This review, going through the medications and allergies with patients routinely, is now a common practice, and I believe it's likely responsible for preventing more medication errors than e-prescribing is. Second, I think it's also a safe bet that for the most part, prior to meaningful use, patients would often leave their doctor's offices with, if anything, verbal instructions. So I would applaud MU for having the foresight to make part of stage one the idea of sharing something with patients. And I would say even though it was not interoperable, a result of MU stage one has been many hundreds of thousands or even millions of patients have left their doctor's offices, sometimes for the first time in their lives, with something that was written and or sent to the portal where they could see their problem list, their med list, their allergy list, and other relevant, concise expressions of the data. And third, the EHR has led to the possibility of performing regular office visits and making them into what I would call transformed office visits with shared agendas, where EHR informational displays and decision alerts make it possible for a visit for any reason to also include awareness and or actions for all unmet preventive and care chronic care opportunities. As an example, in my health system, we have been a partner, in fact, the first large system partner with Health and Human Services Million Hearts Initiative. And what we've done structurally is leverage the EHR as a virtual member of our care team, thus making it possible for every adult primary care visit for every patient to also see, in the case of this Million Hearts Initiative, is there any missing or out-of-date information, or should the patient be considered for aspirin use? So I think these are real benefits, and these are occurring now.
But I'd like to maybe focus for a moment on a very specific benefit, and that was with e-prescribing. Certainly led to a significant drop in prescription errors. So that's one example of an aspect of the electronic health record that adopted quickly to a new way of doing things. How do we take what we benefit from in terms of e-prescriptions and reduced errors to say, how do we turn that into big data that really helps us improve care? How do we take these things you've talked about to a next level of really improving care?
Sure. It's a great question. And actually, you reminded me of an experience that I think is still instructive. 3 months into when I brought my EHR live in my then small primary care practice, there was a recall of a diet pill, and I recall having a conversation with one of my colleagues, and I sat down with her to say, oh gosh, did you see the headline? I'm sure we have some patients on this diet pill combination. And she looked at me and said, well, Peter, don't you know that there's probably a report you can pull to figure out what's in the active med list? And the two of us together 10 minutes later had a list of everybody in our practice who was on that drug, and it started us on a process that we finished probably an hour later of notification and monitoring of those patients. So it's a great example of how we can do things right. A big difference with kind of the narrow business case of e-prescribing. Because it works so well, I would say that once docs get in the habit of doing it and get in used to the workflow, something that is built well is workflow informed. Essentially, it makes the right thing easier to do. I think another benefit is it actually is faster. Once we've introduced docs to e-prescribing in our health system, we found that docs found that e-prescribing was as close to instant as we could get, so it was self-sustaining. I also think there was a critical difference with e-prescribing where it was born of a multi-stakeholder gathering, including stakeholders who, prior to putting e-prescribing together, were competitors in the business market, but they all came together to create a real solution and not just come up with a mandated use requirement on providers.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Bash, an internist and medical director for ambulatory EHR and health IT policy at MedStar Health. Dr. Bash is senior fellow for health IT policy at the Center for American Progress. So you talked a little earlier about ONC, and they've certainly are going through their changes. I'm wondering what your relationship has been with them in this transition, trying to address ONC's one-size-fits-all approach.
Well, you know, I think that ONC is certainly doing the best it can in this point of transition where many of their senior leaders have left. So I think, you know, we're all struggling. So the solution, in my opinion, is not to return to paper. Meaningful use needs to be saved from its own overzealousness with, as I said before, mid-course correction. And I would add that I believe ONC now recognizes this and has started working more closely with provider organizations. Just to restate my opinion, MU needs to make it clear that EHR use should be different for providers in different specialties to achieve benefits for patients and to make the EHR work for providers, which could lead us to having even elegant EHRs that are highly usable feeling clunky in the hands of providers because they just don't meet their workflows. I also believe that ONC should reconsider what it means to be a successful attester for meaningful use. Certainly one path would be for added flexibility, to pick and choose a set of measures based on what makes sense to one's practice. This would certainly move us quickly away from what a lot of docs are focused on now, which are workarounds that make no sense to them in clinical practice, but they have to do them merely to meet all the measures that are required for meaningful use. I think another thing to do is to move away from a model of checking boxes at all. And the purpose of this is not to overburden doctors with checkboxes or to say, doc, now that you've had a EHR use course, make eye contact again with a patient and even use what's in the EHR to help inform your visit, that we, you know, don't reverse that and say, well, now that you got that straight, now you have to look very carefully at what you do and the sequence of what you do because otherwise it doesn't count. You move right ahead to use for quality or improved safety. You know, I'll bring up the example of Million Hearts again, which I think is a wonderful program which can succeed in helping to eliminate 1 million new heart attacks and strokes in this country. If I were someone who is in charge of the program, I would seriously consider at least four relevant specialties of internal medicine, family practice, cardiology, let's say, that involvement in Million Hearts would deem you as a meaningful user.
Well, Dr. Bash, what do you see in terms of how the availability of this electronic technology is changing the way we are training and educating our health professionals of tomorrow? And are people arriving as kind of digital natives? And what's your perspective?
So some of the core issues that we've had with physicians who did not grow up using technology in every other aspect of their lives, we don't see in younger people. I do think that there is a problem, however, in that students are basically still mentored by senior clinicians if they also have, as many more senior physicians do, a negative attitude toward EHRs and health IT, that this is imparted on students. So I think we certainly need to spend more time on better teaching of how to use technology to improve care, not just to document care and digitize the status quo. And I think that we really could spend some time to improve on interviewing skills enabled by health IT so that we no longer have issues, at least for these younger docs who grow up being trained appropriately, with this whole issue of eyes down on a computer screen and forgetting that there's a person in the room.
Absolutely. We've been speaking today with Dr. Peter Bash, an internist medical director for the Ambulatory EHR and Health IT Policy at MedStar Health and senior fellow for the Health IT Policy at the Center for American Progress. You can find his recent article on Health Affairs blog and learn more about his work by going to medstarhealth.org. Dr. Bash, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the midterm elections aren't quite over yet, and that means we're still seeing ads making claims about the Affordable Care Act. In the Louisiana Senate race, Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu and Republican Representative Bill Cassidy will compete in a December 6th runoff. And an ad from the National Republican Senatorial Committee makes the misleading claim that Landrieu agreed with President Obama on, quote, raising our taxes, a reference to her vote for the Affordable Care Act. The law does include about $1 trillion worth of new taxes over 10 years, with the heaviest burden falling on high-income taxpayers. But it also includes more than $1 trillion worth of tax credits. So Landrieu would have voted to lower taxes as well. The law's new taxes include $318 billion in new revenue from taxes on individuals making more than $200,000 a year and couples making more than $250,000. That includes an additional 0.9% Medicare payroll tax and a new 3.8% tax on investment income on those earners. Other taxes include those on high-cost health care plans starting in 2018, a tax on manufacturers of drugs and certain medical devices, and taxes related to the employer and individual mandates. But then there are the health care subsidies, more than $1 trillion worth, for those who buy their own insurance. The nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation estimated in 2013 that about half of those who buy their own health care coverage would be eligible for those tax credits. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. The flu doesn't just exact a toll on public health, it packs a meaningful punch on the economy every year as well. Comprehensive vaccination programs have had an impact on curtailing flu outbreaks, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. In 2011, an estimated 100 million workdays and close to $7 billion in lost wages were attributed to the flu, largely because many employees without paid sick leave are more inclined to work while sick. An estimated 80% of those who come down with flu-like symptoms ignore doctor's orders and go to work, leading to more widespread co-infections. In a first-of-its-kind study, researchers at the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health decided to analyze the impact on flu outbreaks in the workplace and to ask what would the difference be if there were universal access to paid sick leave. Lead researcher Dr. Supriya Kumar says their study showed a pretty dramatic link between access to paid sick leave and a reduction in flu outbreak in the workplace. They also created another option. What if there were a new sick leave category focusing just on flu days? Their model showed that if those workers specifically diagnosed with flu were guaranteed just one paid day off to recuperate, there'd be a 25% reduction in the spread of flu. And when workers were guaranteed two paid days off, the numbers went up to a 40% reduction in co-infection. A universal paid leave program for all workers that has the potential to greatly reduce flu co-infection in the workplace, positively impacting both public health while saving billions of dollars in the overall economy, Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.